continuation of the Truman Youngdahl judgeship. Well, as I said, immediately on reading the news of the death of this district judge in the District of Columbia, I called the White House. I got a hold of Matt Conley, and I told him that I wanted very much to see the president, that it was a matter of some urgency. And he told me that he would call me back just as soon as he could clear with the president an appointment. I went to my office, at the Senate office building, and later on that morning, the president, Matt Conley, called me and said the president would be pleased to see me. I remember arriving there at the White House before noon. And I went in to see, and I walked in to see President Truman. I said to the president that I came to talk to him about a judgeship. He said, "Now, which one is that? Do you have an opening in your state?" And I said, "No, Mr. President, but there's an opening in the district court in the District of Columbia." And he said, "Oh," he said, "well, now," he said, "just a minute." He said, "You know, those judgeships are generally claimed by the senators either from Virginia or Maryland." And then he went on to say, "Now, they don't," he said, "they don't deserve them, but that's what they've been doing in the past." And he said, "I don't see any reason at all why Harry Byrd ought to get a judgeship. Do you, Hubert?" And I said, "Well, not in terms of what he's done to help you, Mr. President, in your administration." I said, "Now let me tell you what I have in mind, Mr. President, if you'll give me a few moments," which he readily did. And then I told him about Luther Youngdahl. I told him about how Luther Youngdahl had been very friendly to the president, how he'd stood up for him on the instance of the firing of dismissal of General MacArthur, and he was the only Republican governor that did so, and how he had also, I recalled to the president the speech that Youngdahl had given at the time of the president's visit to St. Paul in 1950. And then I said, "Mr. President, he's also a very good Shriner and Mason." And then I got right down to the politics of it. I said, "Mr. President, Luther Youngdahl is a personal friend of mine. He's had a lot of trouble with his Republican legislature. He's told me from time to time that he wasn't at all sure that he would run for a re-election to the governorship. But he also indicated to me that a lot of pressure had been brought to bear on him to run against me in 1954. Luther also had told me that he had not been well under this tremendous pressure of the legislature, the battle that he'd had with them. He was very angry, in other words, with many of his Republican compatriots, with many of his fellow Republicans, particularly in the legislature. Luther was too progressive for them. Also, he'd cracked down on gambling, particularly on the slot machines throughout the state. This had gained him considerable popular appeal, but it also had brought him bitter opposition from certain elements in the Republican Party and in the business community, particularly in the resort areas. All of this was bearing heavily on the governor, and he wanted to get out of that job, but his party was openly bringing pressure to bear on him to be a candidate for the United States Senate in the next round, in the next election of 1954. I said, "Mr. President, I think I can beat him, but I can tell you it'd be a tough fight. And if there's any way that we can avoid that fight, I'd like to. Not only because it would be difficult and tough, but because I happen to like Luther Youngdahl. And I don't want to have to be pitted into a political contest, if I can avoid it, with a man whom I respect and whom I like." "Well," the president said, "I understand very well what you're talking about, and let's see if we can't do something about it." He said, "I see no damn reason at all why this judgeship should go to some senator that hasn't done a damn thing for me or this administration." And I knew to whom he was referring. He said, "Do you think that the governor would accept it?" Oh, he said to me, "Have you talked to the governor about it?" I said, "No." But I did relate then to the president that incident at Ray Ewald's home, and how I knew that Governor Youngdahl wanted to be a federal judge above all other things. He said, "Well, do you think that he would accept it?" And I said, "I think he would." He said, "Well, why don't you find out whether he would or not? Because I don't want to offer it to him if he's going to turn it down." So why don't you find out what his attitude would be and report back to me. And he said, by the way, I want you to report just directly to me. I want this conversation to be very private. He said, you can ask for an appointment through Matt, but I want you to talk to me about it and only to me. I left the White House hoping that I would be able to pull this off. I called out to the governor's office, but he wasn't there. I called out to the governor's brother, Reuben Youngdahl, to talk with him, because I thought it might be a little hazardous to call directly to the governor's office and to talk to the governor while he was in the office. I was sure that someone might overhear it, or that the word would get out, and it was important that this be kept secret and that we act quickly. I tried to get a hold of my friend Reuben Youngdahl, the governor's brother. Lo and behold, he was up north in the northern part of Minnesota fishing. And Reuben liked to go to faraway places. I finally was able to track him down, and after a better than a day's effort, was able to get him on the telephone. And I said to Reuben, I'd like very much to be able to talk to Luther about something that we visited about out at Ray Ewald's home. Is there any way that I could get to him and have him call me at a point where it would be convenient, at a time that would be convenient for him and from a place that would be secure? I told him to call me at my home, if possible, that evening. Well, Reuben got a hold of his brother and indicated and told his brother, the governor, that he'd heard from me and that I had a very important message for him, and that it related to a conversation that we'd had at Ray Ewald's home. I waited. That evening, the governor called me, and I said to the governor in rather guarded terms, are you interested in the matter that we discussed with Ray Ewald? If you are, I think there is something available. And he said, well, what would it be? And I said, in the District of Columbia. And I was worried that the governor would not want to come down to Washington. That above that, what he wanted more than anything else was a federal district judgeship in the state of Minnesota. He said, I'm interested. And I said, will you come to Washington? And he said he would. And I said, well, get a plane and get in here as soon as you can. Let me know what flight you're coming in on. I'll have somebody pick you up. I'll register you into the hotel under an assumed name, because I don't want any publicity. This was done. He was registered into the Statler Hotel under an assumed name. I believe we used the name West. He came into the hotel at night, and at 8:30 the next morning, at 9 o'clock the next morning, I believe it was, we were at the White House. I had called the president, I'd called the White House and asked for Matt Conley, and told Matt that I wanted to see the president, and that the president had told me that I could come whenever I called. And he informed the president of my call, and the president got on the telephone and told me to bring the governor into the west entrance of the White House and up the steps back into a waiting room and to remain there until he, the president, came for us. Well, the governor was picked up at the Statler Hotel. I brought him on over to the west entrance of the White House. The president had apparently notified the guards, and we proceeded directly through that entrance, up the steps, into the waiting room on the opposite side of Matt Conley's office, and just off the Oval Room from the president. In a few minutes, the president opened the door and said, gentlemen, come in. He stuck his hand, he put his hand out and shook hands with the governor and with me. And right out of the blue, he said, "Governor, do you want to be a federal judge? If you do, I've got a position for you. I've got a judgeship for you." I looked at the governor. There was no wasted conversation at all at this point. And the governor said, "Well, tell me about it. I'm interested." And the president said, "Well, there's an opening here in the District of Columbia for the federal district bench. Hubert has been over here to talk to me about it. If you want it, you can have it. But I got to know. I'd like your answer." And at that point, Governor Youngdahl said, "I want it." Our business was completed. But that was not the end of the conversation. After that, the president sat down with the governor and they discussed a whole lot of things. They discussed Minnesota Lakes. They discussed MacArthur. They discussed masonry. And for about half an hour, we were in the White House, of which at least 29 minutes of it was just pleasant conversation because the business of the visit had been completed the very first minute. Following the meeting, following the discussion with the president, I asked the governor if we could just visit a little while as to how we were going to make this announcement. The governor wanted very much to make the announcement to the press himself rather than have it coming from me. I could understand that because it was a rather unusual situation. What the governor wanted, of course, was that to be able to project the message, to convey the message that the president had asked him to take this judgeship rather than I had recommended it. But we were able to work that out very well. We walked out into the west wing of the White House, into the reception room, and I called the pressmen that were there together and said, the governor of the state of Minnesota, Mr. Youngdahl, has an announcement he would like to make. Well, lo and behold, there was only one pressman there from Minnesota. I had tried to alert the Minnesota press to the fact that I was going to the White House that day and hoped that they would be present. But one of the reporters thought it was more important to cover a meeting of the Post Office and Civil Service Committee on which a Republican by the name of Harold Hagan was serving in the House of Representatives. Our press was apparently uninterested in the fact that one of the senators from Minnesota was having a visit with the president. It would seem to me rather obvious that if a senator was to have a visit with the president, that it might have some meaning and some importance. But this reporter didn't seem to feel that way. The St. Paul Pioneer Press reporter was there and present. The Minneapolis Tribune reporter, for the moment, was absent. And when the announcement was made, that reporter from the St. Paul Pioneer Press and Dispatch literally lost his teeth. He couldn't believe it. He asked me about it at the conference, and I said that I was very pleased that the president had made this offer, and that I was particularly pleased that the governor of Minnesota had seen fit to accept it. The reporter said, "Well, Governor, does this mean that you're going to resign your governorship?" And he said, "That's exactly what I intend to do." And he said, "When?" And he said, "As soon as possible." Well, the news flashed back to Minnesota. In the meantime, the other reporter from the Minneapolis papers had gotten wind of it and called into my office very agitated and wanted to know why he hadn't been informed. And he was told by me that he was informed, that I was to be at the White House that morning to see the president. He said, "Well, why didn't you tell me the governor was coming?" Because I said that wasn't necessary, that a good reporter that a good reporter ought to be over to the White House when the senator from his state, from that reporter state, was having a visit and having a conference with the president. that I thought it was possibly a little bit more important than trying to find out about postage stamps or postage rates over to the House Committee on Post Office and Civil Service. Well, the reporter got his story, but he was a little late as compared to the competing newspaper in the capital city of St. Paul. When the news reached Minnesota, it was a bombshell. The former governor, Harold Stassen, was there. And when the reporters was visiting in Minnesota at the time, and when the reporters got to him, he was literally in a state of shock. He said something to the effect that this was a dirty political trick on the part of Hubert Humphrey, and proceeded to attack me for having enticed the governor into this appointment. Well, I was very unconcerned as to what Mr. Stassen thought about it or any other Republican. What I was pleased about was that the governor had accepted. It was good for him, it was good for me, and as it turned out to be, it was good for the nation, because Governor Youngdahl, who became Judge Luther Youngdahl, has one of the most distinguished records of any judge on the federal bench. He brought honor to himself, to the legal profession, and to our courts. The governor was succeeded by the lieutenant governor, C. Elmer Anderson. The lieutenant governor, to say the least, was not a man of charisma or a powerful political image. He was a very modest man, and most people considered him weak and inept. He was a decent fellow. He'd run a magazine and newspaper service in Brainerd, Minnesota. A successful businessman, but not a particularly effective political speaker or political leader. I'm being generous. Quite honestly, he was weak and rather nondescript. The Republicans knew this, and they knew that Luther Youngdahl's acceptance of the federal judgeship placed them in a most difficult position, particularly for the 1954 elections. They knew that the lieutenant governor was not capable of giving strong leadership to the party, and that no one had ever looked upon him as an effective spokesman or leader in our state. I recall, however, going back to Minnesota after the appointment of Luther Youngdahl and meeting with one of the gentlemen in the Minneapolis Tribune. His name was Gideon Seymour, a decent and remarkable man, a decent and brilliant man, and a very dear and personal friend to me. Gideon Seymour was one of the leading editorialists in our nation, and a man that I respected very much. But the paper was Republican, particularly on state politics. It had always treated me fair and well. But when it came to state elections, it was, in the main, a strong advocate of, an open advocate of the Republican ticket. When I was visiting with my friend Gideon Seymour, he looked to me and said, "You know, Hubert, you think you've pulled a pretty big political coup, and indeed you have. The Republicans are in a state of shock. But I think I ought to tell you what's going to happen. The man that succeeds Governor Youngdahl's, Mr. C. Elmer Anderson, who many people have labeled Casper Milquetoast, that this man is going to start to look good, and we're going to help make him look good." C. Elmer Anderson would meet with people and have little or nothing to say. He would, whenever a picture would be taken of him, he would always be more or less just sitting and waiting and listening no one ever came away from those meetings feeling that the lieutenant governor was going to be a strong advocate of their cause, no matter what group was in to talk to him. Well, I remember this good editor friend of mine saying to me, "Hubert, when the Republicans get through building up C. Elmer, and we get through reporting it, those times that he looks there just like he is listening and doesn't know what's going on, we're going to make it look like he is listening, pondering, and meditating, and knowing what's going on. We're going to make the fact that he can't make speech a positive asset. He's going to be interpreted as a man who doesn't talk, but quietly gets things done. In other words, his every weakness will be built into an asset. And I think you ought to know it." He was telling me two things. Number one, that the Republican strategy, what was going to be the Republican strategy. And number two, how the paper was going to cooperate. And indeed, that was the case. In that election of 1954, Orville Freeman was the candidate. In that election in 1952, Orville Freeman was the candidate and for governor. And believe me, he put on one whale of a campaign. But C. Elmer Anderson won, and primarily because he had the unqualified support of the press. And that in 1952, Dwight Eisenhower was the candidate for president on the Republican ticket, carrying Minnesota. In 1954, the things were different. But again, C. Elmer Anderson, the man that succeeded Luther Youngdahl, continued to act in his same quiet, impassive, apathetic way. And I recall in that campaign, there's no need of getting into the 54 campaign right now, we'll hold off on that. But President Truman, in the appointment of Luther Youngdahl, had not only helped me, but indeed he'd helped Luther Youngdahl, whose health was failing at that time under the stress of the governorship and the tension in his party. Luther became well and strong. But more significantly, President Truman, in selecting and appointing Luther Youngdahl, placed on the bench of the Federal District Court one of the most honorable, intelligent, and forward-looking jurists in any of the courts of our land. Luther Youngdahl also was in a vital spot, the District Court in the District of Columbia, where so many important cases came and where so much of court law was made. The nation was lucky. The nation was fortunate. It was my good luck, and the appointment was to the everlasting credit of Harry Truman. I have another reflection on President Truman that tells a little bit about the man. As we recall, the Trumans had to leave the White House because of its bad state of repair. And they moved over to the Blair House somewhere around 1951 or so. Around 1950, 51, we get the right date there. President Truman would invite to the Blair House from time to time a number of senators and congressmen just to sit down and have dinner with him and visit. He went out of his way to keep his contacts with the Congress And he was very proud, of course, of the fact that he'd been a United States Senator. He seemed to enjoy the company of senators and would have them in as often as time would permit. I remember that my first visit to the Blair House and talking with the president. He had just sent his budget up to the Congress. Well, every time a budget message came up, it was subject to unbelievable attack and criticism by most of the press and, of course, by the number of the conservatives in the Democratic Party and generally by most of the Republicans. I was accused of being a profligate spender in the press back home in Minnesota, particularly in the weekly press. Every bill that I introduced, there was a price tag put on it, and the local editors were keeping sort of a running account of the cost of my proposed legislation. As time went on, it became perfectly obvious that if you were going to get any favorable mention at home, that you simply had to be opposed to some things that Mr. Truman stood for. I said to my office staff one day, I'm going to show you how to get a headline in the local newspapers back home. I'm going to prove to you that all you need to do as a Democrat is to just show some doubt or some lack of loyalty or support of President Truman, and all at once you'll become a hero. And you'll be in the column, you'll be in the press, and favorably mentioned. This was indeed, this was just a demonstration on my part of how it could be done. Richard Wilson of the Minneapolis Star and Tribune was the reporter that came to my office. He asked me what I thought about the budget, the president's budget. And I said, I think it's too much. I think it's extravagant. There's waste in it. And we can eliminate, I've forgotten now, we can eliminate $2 to $3 billion without in any way weakening that, without in any way jeopardizing essential government services or denying the American people what they need and deserve. And then he said to me, well, where would you make those cuts? Without having even studied the budget, I picked out two or three places and said, I think in these areas. And I listed two or three areas, including some in the Defense Department, some in the Public Works area, some in the field of social programs. I got a great story back home. Front page article noting that Senator Humphrey had broken with President Truman on the budget and that he was recommending substantial cuts. It was one of the first good news stories that I'd had for a long time. And lo and behold, I even got an editorial which read in substance that at long last, the senator from Minnesota makes sense, that I'd recommended a budget cut. Well, my predictions came true. I was in the paper. I got a favorable news story and an even more favorable editorial. But I felt sheepish and cheap about the whole thing. And particularly when I was overseeing the president and listening to him explain his budget and asking for our help. I had a copy of the editorial along with me, and as we left that evening from the Blair House, I said to the president, Mr. President, I want you to know what I've done, and I want you to read this editorial. I showed him the article and watched his countenance as he read it. And I said to him, Mr. President, I really feel ashamed that I've done this, but I just wanted to prove to my staff what it takes to get a good story when you're when you're a Truman Democrat. He said, well, did it help you to make that statement about the budget? I said, well, it helped me, but I don't think it was very good to you. He said, well, don't worry about that. The most important thing is if it helped you, you feel free to attack me anytime if you think it's going to be of help to you out home there in Minnesota. Because he said, I know you're with me, but we need you here. I couldn't help but remember that. I couldn't help but reflect on the thoughtfulness of the man and also of his political astuteness. He knew that I was his supporter. Both in jest and in seriousness, I'm sure that he said what he did. Namely, if it helps you to kick me in the shins, go ahead and do it. It may hurt, but I know it's from a friend. The plain-spoken man who understood the needs of a senator once again revealed his true sense of decency and understanding. Another incident that I remember so well to the food needs of India. The country was suffering from a bad crop and was in desperate need of wheat. We had a surplus supply of wheat, but at the time we had no legislation or legislative authority that would authorize the gift of American wheat to India or any program or any form of concessional sales. That is a price, a reduced price and a long terms with very low rates of interest for a payment. All of this was prior to the enactment of what we call Public Law 480. I had received a first-hand report relating to the food needs of India from a Methodist bishop who had spent some 25 years in that country. I will get his name again. It seems to escape me. I called President Truman and asked if he would have time to listen to the story of this, the report of the bishop as to the conditions that prevailed in India. Lo and behold, once again, President Truman readily agreed to give me the give of his time for a visit with the bishop and myself. The bishop presented the story of famine and of hunger in India and urged the president to do whatever he could to be of help. The president said that he would do his level best to be of assistance. Following that meeting, I started to speak in the Senate about the urgent necessity of American assistance to India. I contacted the American Red Cross and asked if there was anything that it could do to be of help. I appealed to young people throughout the country to do anything that they could, even in the form of monetary contributions. I was able to convince the American Red Cross to accept contributions, financial contributions for the purchase of food for India. Young people and others were sending in little token bags of wheat, which were being deposited at the door of the Indian embassy as an expression of our interest in and concern about the people of India. And substantial amounts of wheat were being purchased and actually loaded on ships out of our harbors on the eastern seaboard to go to India. I addressed the nation over a Columbia Broadcasting System radio broadcast on the food situation, on the conditions of hunger and famine that existed in some parts of India, and asked people for their help, urged them to make their contributions to the Red Cross. I called a meeting of all the voluntary agencies in my office at Washington. In other words, just as one senator, I was trying to take some leadership in arousing the nation's interest and concern over the desperate plight of the Indian people. Later on, I introduced legislation to authorize the emergency shipment of food to India. I believe it was in the sum of 4 million tons, which is a substantial amount, and of course was desperately needed and arrived at a very fortuitous time, thereby preventing widespread famine. It appeared for a while that we would be able to do all of this in the form of a gift, but the Prime Minister Nehru, in addressing the Indian Parliament, indicated that India would prefer to make some kind of purchase, obviously under terms that were generous, and over which the and repayment over a long period of time. Our emergency loan of wheat to India met the requirements that had been suggested by the Prime Minister. I point out that here again that there was this great sense of pride on the part of the Indian people and the leadership of India. They knew they were in desperate straits, but they did not want charity. They preferred to have some kind of commercial relationship that would, on the one hand, provide the food promptly, but permit the Indian government to repay over a long, long period of time. All of this was worked out. I can recall that when I first talked to the president about this, I had mentioned to him that I'd hoped that the State Department would be cooperative. I had been to the State Department already and had been told, of course, that there was no legislation and that there was no and that they couldn't act. I said at that time that the problem for them was not the matter of legislation, that was something we would take care of in the Senate and hopefully, or in the Congress, and hopefully I would be able to take the leadership on it. My point was, would they give us support? Could I expect help from the State Department if we introduce such legislation as a form of economic assistance to India? I really didn't receive very much encouragement, to be frank about it. So when I spoke to the president, and after we'd had the talk, after the bishop had joined me in our visit with the president, I mentioned to the president that we surely would need the help of the State Department. And he said to me, "Why, of course." He said, "I'll see that that comes promptly. You will just, I'll just call up the dean and Dean Acheson and tell him that we want to do everything we can to get this legislation through the Congress and to provide the food assistance that is so needed." I didn't tell the president that I'd already been to the State Department, but I must say that after I returned to my office that day, having visited with the president, within 2 to 3 hours, a call came from the Secretary of State saying that he was prepared, that he wanted me to know that he was prepared to lend every effort of the State Department and his own personal efforts in accomplishing, in the securing the passage of the appropriate legislation to authorize the shipment of American grain to India. It was just another example of where a president who takes his stand, who exerts his leadership, can overcome the natural reticence and conservatism of the bureaucracy and obtain the assistance that can direct the departments of government to move and to get on the ball. As I recall, my first visit in the State Department on this matter was with James Webb, who was the Undersecretary of State. And it was he who informed me that there was no money in the budget for such a proposal as mine. There was no legislation that would authorize any type of shipment of, any large shipment of wheat to India. And therefore, there really wasn't much that could be done about it. But after having spoken to the president and laid the facts out before him, it was interesting to see how quickly that same department that on one day didn't see much hope for anything being done, the next day was championing the cause. This is what we mean by presidential leadership. And Harry Truman knew how to exert it. Well, the wheat went to India, and it was the beginning of our long, it was the beginning of America, it was the beginning of a substantial assistance to the Indian democracy. I always felt that that country deserved our attention and our support, and due to this day, it was struggling to make a representative government, a parliamentary system, work. It was a country that had come out of the colonial status into its own independence, and it had not followed the path of dictatorship or of a governing, or the generals governing the country, or a military junta, J-U-N-T-A. It had gone down the more difficult trail of elections, of free elections, of free speech, of freedom of assembly, of the right to petition the government, and of representative government and parliamentary democracy. Despite the fact that the Indian leadership at times was very difficult to work with, I felt that we must make the effort. After all, the government of India had to respond to the needs and sometimes even the prejudices of its own people. Therefore, it was not always willing to bow to the will of our desires or to our public policies. It had to follow its own independent course. But the important thing about India, insofar as American policy was concerned, was that it was a free country, an independent country, that it was being governed under democratic principles and institutions. It had a parliamentary government with free elections. To me, this was the importance of India, and therefore that we should lean over backwards to be of help to her, regardless of how difficult our relationships might become at times, and indeed they became strained and difficult. Simply because India was having to, it's simply because the Indian became difficult and strained at times. I suppose in part this was due to the fact that the Indian leaders had to be continuously conscious of and concerned about the attitudes of their own people. Also, there were many political parties in India, and indeed the Communist Party was very active. But the important thing was that the Congress Party, which was the majority party in India, represented true independence and progressive democracy. And it was this kind of a government that I thought ought to have the full and generous support of the United States. During those early years in the Senate, I was often called the Senator for India by my old friend, Senator Paul Douglas. I always believed that if you just take a look at the map of Asia, you would see that India was so strategically located. It was the underbelly, so to speak, of the Asian continent. It represented a half a billion people. And more importantly, as I've said, it represented a determined effort on the part of a people who had just come out of the colonial system to become a free and independent democratic country. Therefore, it needed our encouragement. It needed our generous assistance, and a country like India, above all, as struggling to overcome almost insurmountable problems, needed our patience and our forbearance. The food aid was a vital necessity, was desperately needed, and fortunately, that first effort at assistance, that first successful effort at food assistance, helped India through a very critical period. Later on, we were also called upon in the 1960s to be of help to India with a substantial amount of food assistance. But we had the food, and I always felt that by extending food assistance, we were doing the most decent and noblest of things. We were saving lives. Food was not only feeding hungry people, but the income from that. The income from the food that was given or that was provided by the United States to India was also used to promote economic development. Something that I should recall and put in the book When I first came to Washington in 1948, following the election in November, I had the opportunity of meeting with the personal secretary of the former president, Herbert Hoover. This occasion took place, this meeting took place following the Gridiron Dinner in December of 1948. This was my first experience at a gridiron. It was my first experience at a gridiron dinner, period. It was indeed some affair. All of the big men, all of the corporate leaders, all of the top corporate leaders were there, the top publishers of the leading newspapers, the president, members of the president's cabinet, Supreme Court judges, ambassadors. If ever there was what you call a blue ribbon, blue chip dinner, this was it. I was invited because I was one of those that had won an important election, and I was the guest of the Minneapolis, of the Kohl's Publishing Company people. In other words, John Kohl's and Gardner Kohl's of the Minneapolis Star and Tribune. How well I remember that great evening. It was an exciting one for me. It was the evening at which President Truman mimicked Kaltenborn. It was Kaltenborn, of course, who announced that Truman had been defeated and Dewey had been elected. It was the evening when the headline of the Chicago Tribune announcing Truman's defeat and Dewey's election was projected in the satirical songs of the Gridiron Glee Club. The Gridiron Dinner is short on speeches, but long on musical comedy. Members of the Gridiron Club, dash a highly exclusive club of newspaper reporters, put on a series of skits poking fun at the Republicans and the Democrats and individual members leading members of the two political parties. It is the highlight of the political season. At the head table, which by the way is a gigantic head table, stretching all around at least half of the ballroom at the Statler Hotel, sit the prominent people, of politics, the court, the cabinet, Congress, the House, the Senate, and of course publishers who and the officers of the Gridiron Club. Generally, the president and the vice president attend. Or at least the vice president. In this instance, the president attended as well. Following that dinner, there are a series. Following the dinner, there are a series of parties hosted by different newspaper publishers or different newspaper publishers. I attended the one given by the Kohl's publication. It was there that I met a gentleman who was the private secretary of Herbert Hoover. We had quite a visit. He'd asked me if I'd ever met Mr. Hoover, and I said I had not. He then informed me that the former president was in Washington, that I might want to have an opportunity to meet with him. We got to talking about the Hoover Commission reports. President Truman had appointed Herbert Hoover as the chairman of a special commission to examine into the structure of the executive branch of government and to make recommendations for its modernization and its improvement of its efficiency. The Hoover Commission report was gaining considerable attention, and would be one and would be recommended to the, and its recommendations would soon be brought to the Congress for purposes of legislative action. A whole series of reorganization plans would be presented to carry out the recommendations of the Hoover Commission. Well, as a new senator, I was keenly interested in this subject. I had tried to do some reorganizing of the government of the city of Minneapolis, and I had a keen interest as a student of public administration in the work of the Hoover Commission. Mr. Hoover's secretary told me that Hoover's secretary suggested that I might want to meet with the former president, and I readily seized the opportunity. Later on, after I had taken the oath of office and was in the early days of my Senate work, I called Mr. Hoover at his suite in the Mayflower Hotel in Washington. I spoke to his secretary and asked if it would be possible, when it would be possible for me to see the former president. I was given an immediate appointment, and very shortly, early one morning, I stopped by to pay my respects to President Hoover and to have a visit with him. I recall coming into President Hoover's suite. He was there at the door to welcome me and to greet me. I was impressed by the physical stature of the man. He was tall and he looked strong. Prior to his taking on the work of the commission, he had been somewhat ill, but just the challenge of the Hoover Commission itself had seemed to reinvigorate the man. I had learned that President Truman had a high regard for Herbert Hoover, and that the two had become good friends. When I sat down to talk with the former president, I was quite candidly both nervous and somewhat embarrassed. We discussed for some time the work of the commission, and I told the former president that I wanted very much to be of help, and that I assured him that I would do all that I could as one senator to bring about the acceptance and the adoption of the recommendations of his commission. At that time was not quite sure just how they would be presented to the Congress, nor was I sure of what committee assignments I would have. But I explained to the former president that of my interest in public administration, and wanted very much, and assured him that I wanted very much to see prompt action on the part of Congress relating to the proposals made by the commission. Following that part of our visit, I simply had to tell the former president something that was bothering me. And I said it something like this. I said, "Mr. President, I am embarrassed to, I'm somewhat embarrassed to be sitting here talking to you. Over the brief years of my public life, I've been very unkind to you. I've been a stern critic, and I'm afraid I've said some things about you that might very well have been unfair and improper. I didn't quite know how to explain to the former president the nature of my partisan attacks upon him, and indeed my sincere differences with some of the things that he had advocated during his presidency. But after I sort of stumbled through it all and obviously exhibited some embarrassment, this good man said to me, "Well, I understand this. My only question I have to ask you is, did it help you?" And I said I wasn't sure. What he said, if it helped you, then it was all right. He sort of made light of it and bid me farewell with a good friendly handshake. I left that meeting even more determined to do all in my power to bring about the acceptance of the Hoover Commission proposals. I did just that. I became a member of the Committee on Government Operations and the chairman of the Subcommittee on Government Reorganization. It was to this subcommittee and this full committee that many of the Hoover Commission recommendations were referred. I handled those. I was able to process those recommendations and to report them for action to the Congress, to the Senate. Later on, I received a citation from the Citizens Committee of the Hoover Commission, the committee that was doing all that it could to encourage public support for the Hoover Commission recommendations. I believe that that commission set a high standard for presidential commission work. And many a commission since that time has been patterned on the formula or the structure of the Hoover Commission. One of the great things about this period, one of the good things about the Hoover Commission was that it brought back into public life the former president and gave him an opportunity to demonstrate his leadership qualities and indeed his statesmanship. To the everlasting credit of President Truman, he brought Herbert Hoover out of retirement. He gave him an opportunity to once again perform great public service and indeed to, in a sense, redeem his name in the political arena. I'm sure that many of the criticisms leveled against Mr. Hoover were unfair and unjustified. He was in a sense the victim of the Depression and had to suffer the consequences for all that had developed in those bitter years of the 1930s. His being called back into action by President Truman gave the man a new lease of life, and he demonstrated once again why he was looked upon in the years of the 1920s and in the 1920s as a truly great man. What a privilege it was for me as a young United States Senator to get to know this man. These are some of the intangible rewards of public life, and to know Herbert Hoover, to see him at work, and to realize his greatness was indeed a rare privilege. I want to dictate just a little addition on the Joseph McCarthy period. Two men, more than any other, challenged the demagoguery and the evil of McCarthyism. One was Ralph Flanders, great United States Senator from Vermont. And the other was William Benton, my friend, and a truly one of the most remarkable men I've ever known. He was then the senator from Connecticut. Senator Benton, who introduced a resolution calling for the censure of Senator McCarthy and his expulsion from the United States Senate. Bill Benton made a brilliant speech fully documented his charges against the senator from Wisconsin. Following that speech, I said to him, to take on McCarthy, that Bill Benton